What is the goal of every Christian parent in regard to their kids? I want you to fill in the blank on this statement. The goal of every Christian parent is to what in regard to their kids? Think about that for just a moment. Well, obviously, in this context, there are certain answers we would expect. But maybe I can summarize them in this way. The goal of every Christian parent is to raise children who know the Lord. Well, how do we do that? What if we are like this real biblical parent, a parent from the Bible who really existed, who did these things? What if, like this real biblical parent, we loved God? And we showed our love for God in the things that we did. And we didn't just love God, but we also loved our kids like this real Christian or this real biblical parent did. And not just that we loved God and loved our kids, but we also brought our kids to church, as it were, or raised them in the church. What if we get our kids involved in spiritual things early on? Well, that's exactly, I would suggest, what Eli did. As we find described in 1 Samuel chapter 2, but his sons did not know the Lord. Open up your Bible, if you would, and turn to 1 Samuel chapter 2. We'll begin reading in verse 12. 1 Samuel chapter 2, beginning in verse 12. We'll refer to things in chapter 3 and 4 also this morning in our lesson. Thank you so much for being here. I know some of you are coming from work. Others of you maybe had late shifts last night. And yet you're here, and I appreciate so much the effort that was required to be here and place an emphasis on these spiritual things. And I trust that the things that we study, because they're going to be from God's Word, will be something that is hopefully edifying to you, but also convicting. Help all of us to be better citizens in God's kingdom, hopefully better parents as well, if that applies to us. I want you to look, if you would, beginning in verse 12 of 1 Samuel chapter 2, to illustrate what it is that I've got on the board behind me. Now, the sons of Eli were corrupt. They did not know the Lord. And the priest's custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, when the priest's servant would come with a three-pronged flesh hook in his hand while the meat was boiling. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot, and the priest would take for himself all that the flesh hook brought up. So they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. Also, before they burned the fat, the priest's servant would come and say to the man who sacrificed, "Give me meat for roasting to the priest, for he will not take boiled meat from you, but raw." Now, there were at least three violations of the law of Moses to be found in these few verses. Number one, as priests, they were given specific portions of the meat. We might say given specific cuts of meat that belonged to the priests, that the priest could take and use to feed themselves and consume of the sacrifices. And instead of carefully taking the designated cuts of meat, instead they'd get this three-pronged flesh hook. You can imagine that. Just put it into the pot, and whatever came out, they got to keep it. Number two, by implication, they were taking some of what should have gone back to those making the offering. So they weren't just taking their designated portion, they were also taking a portion from the people who were coming to offer the sacrifice. And number three, most egregiously, they were not satisfied with their own portion, and some of the portion of the one coming to make the sacrifice, they also took the fat that was supposed to be burned off. And whose portion was that? That was God's. So they took their own portion, they took some of the person who was offering their portion, and they also took God's portion of the sacrifice. We summarize that. They went beyond what was authorized by the law. They stole from the people, and they stole from God. And there were some people who didn't like it. Some people who called them out on it in verse 16. "And if any man said to him, 'They really should burn the fat first, then you may take as much as your heart desires,' he would then answer him, 'No, but you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force.'" Now, these people, some of them knew the law, And they said, well, really, we should burn the fat off first. That belongs to God. And they said, no, you're going to give it to me. And if you don't, I'm going to take it from you. So what is the end result of all of this? Verse 17, therefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred the offering of the Lord. People despised going to worship God because of these two young priests, because of Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas. Their sins didn't stop there. If you drop down to verse 22 of the same chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 2. Now Eli was very old and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. We don't know a whole lot about these women. We know from other portions of Scripture that they were young virgin women who would come to volunteer at the tabernacle, come to volunteer to serve God and be involved in spiritual things. And these two priests were seducing these women, committing fornication with them. Or in the case of Phinehas, we know that he's married and he's committing adultery with these young ladies who are coming to try and serve God. And it doesn't stop there. We learn later that they took the Ark of the Lord away from the tabernacle and used it as some kind of trinket in order to try and win a battle. These men were sinful men who did not know God. And yet, Eli's sons did not know the Lord, and yet he did all of these things on the screen behind me. And our task this morning, as we think about raising our children to know God, I want us to try and avoid the parenting mistakes of Eli that we see him make in this text. His sons did not know the Lord. They show that they know tradition, that they know obligation and duty, they know benefit and superstition to the Lord in this passage, but they have no real relationship with Him. They have no faith, certainly no personal faith in God. And so often we ask questions like, why do kids grow up and are willing to change religion for their own benefit? Well, because they do not know the Lord. Why do kids grow up and think they can be involved in sexual misconduct and still be a Christian? Because they do not know the Lord. Why do kids grow up and quit listening to their parents? Because they do not know the Lord. Why do kids grow up and see God as one who can be manipulated for their own purposes, as some sort of genie in a bottle? Because they do not know the Lord. Now, I want to stop right here before we go any further and say unequivocally that that wasn't all Eli's fault, of course. In chapter 3 and verse 13, the text says that his sons made themselves vile. Our kids make their own decisions as adults. And ultimately, all of us must stand before God for the things that we have done in the body, whether they be good or whether they be evil. And none of us as parents, and may I say that this is the most scary thing about being a parent, I can't make my kids do what's right when they get out on their own. I can't make them have a relationship with the Lord. And this lesson is not a guilt trip to those of you who have raised your children. You did the best that you could, and then your children make their own life decisions. But may I encourage you to keep trying to have an influence on them and on your grandchildren. But what this lesson is really intended this morning is a warning to those of us who are still raising our children or our grandchildren. Something was clearly missing in the raising of Eli's children that resulted in no real faith for them, that they did not know the Lord. And again, the problem was not that Eli didn't love God. He did. He had faith. And twice we see his blessings that he pronounces on others carried out by the Lord because of his faith. The problem was not that he didn't love his kids. We see, I think, from this text that he did love his sons and love them dearly. The problem was not that he didn't bring his kids to church, so to speak. Eli did. They were raised in and around the tabernacle of meeting. And the problem was not that he didn't get his kids involved soon enough in spiritual things. Eli did. It seems that these two young men, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests at a very young age. The problem was not that Eli didn't do these four things. The problem is that these four things are not enough. Not in and of themselves. These four things are good and right and important. But it was what Eli failed to do as a parent that was the problem. And I want to point out this morning four specific parenting mistakes made by Eli that we need to avoid in our own lives. And maybe these aren't all the mistakes that he made, but these are four mistakes that we see in our text. Number one, Eli made exceptions for his children's behavior that he would not have made for others. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 1. 1 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 12. Obviously, we're in the book of 1 Samuel. Samuel is the young child who's going to be born and dedicated to the Lord. He is going to be Hannah's son. But when we pick up in chapter 1, Hannah has no children. And she is the favorite of her husband's two wives, but the other wife has lots of children, and she provokes Hannah because of this. And so Hannah, as they go and worship God every year, and they have their portion, Hannah is terribly upset and grieved because she has no children. And so she prays to God before the tabernacle of the Lord in anguish, and she makes a vow. She says, "If you'll give me a child, I will devote him to you. I will give him back to you." And in verse 12, "And it happened, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli watched her mouth." She was doing what a lot of us do, right? When I pray to myself, my lips are going to be moving a little bit as I say those things, perhaps. Now, Hannah spoke in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she was drunk. So Eli said to her, "How long will you be drunk? Put your wine away from you." But Hannah answered and said, "No, my Lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor intoxicating drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I have spoken until now." Then Eli answered and said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong on that, I was mistaken." No apology comes. But he does say this, "Go in peace, and the Lord God of Israel grant your petition which you have asked of him." And she said, "Let your maidservant find favor in your sight." So the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. We see that Eli calls out Hannah for her drunkenness here. He goes when he sees her lips moving, and without sure proof, he comes and he tells her explicitly, "How long will you be drunk? Put away your drunkenness." And he had no problem calling out this woman by the tabernacle of meeting. But he doesn't rebuke his own sons for their own excess, for their own sins, at least not like he should. And may I suggest that things are easy to see in others that we aren't always willing to see in ourselves. And it's the same thing with our children. Sometimes it's easy to see the faults of other people's kids, but not our own. You know, when you've been married a little while, you kind of get your shticks, you know, the things that you and your spouse do that maybe just be kind of weird to other people or other people wouldn't really get, but it's kind of fun to you and you enjoy it and it's one of your things, right? Well, one of our shticks, Stephanie and I, is when we have an opportunity to go out on a date without the kids. We go to a nice restaurant or whatever the case might be. This is going to sound terrible. This is what we do. We pretend like we're being super judgmental to the people who are there with kids, right? And so we don't ever say it where anybody else could hear, but we're like, "Can you believe that they would bring kids to a place like this?" You know, even though we brought our own kids there last week or whatever it was, right? And that's just kind of fun. It's just something we do. But it also kind of reminds us of a couple of things, doesn't it? It reminds us, maybe, that we need to have a little bit more empathy toward those people. We've been there, right? Our kids have acted up in a restaurant before. And it also gives us some perspective. when you're there and the kids next on the table next to you are acting like hellions or whatever, and you say, are our kids like that? Does it just wash over us because we're around them all the time? It reminds us, perhaps, of how we want our children to behave. And if anything, we as parents should have higher expectations for our own children than we do for others. The day will come. In fact, with Madison, my oldest, it's already come once. But I know as they get older and, Lord willing, we're all blessed with life and the Lord doesn't come again, as they become teenagers, those questions will come. Why can't I do this thing that everybody else is doing? How do we answer that? Well, no child of mine is going to be doing such and such. Well, okay, fine. But shouldn't the answer be because it doesn't please God to do that? Because we know the Lord? Because no child of God should be doing that. And we want you to know the Lord. Now, the tough thing is to teach our children not to be judgmental and condescending in this, but to be compassionate. And they have to learn that from us. There's a lady that I know here not too long ago. We were talking about immodesty because they have daughters and we have daughters, and how we set those standards at an early age and those sorts of things. And she was talking about, she and her daughter were out somewhere, I think it was at the mall, and they saw a woman who was immodestly dressed, and her daughter loudly said, "Mother, she's immodest. I can't believe she's dressed like that." And this lady proudly said, "My 5-year-old daughter knows better than she does how to dress." Well, it's good that she knows that, but I don't get to be holier than thou because I know what's right. I need to count my blessings that I know what's right. And we need to teach our children that as well, that we don't get to look down our noses at others because we know the Lord. We need to have compassion and want them to know the Lord also. Our girls are old enough to notice some of those things in regard to modesty. And Stephanie says things like this to them. No one has ever told her that she was immodest. And isn't that sad? We need to dress modestly so others can see what's right. All of us are sitting or standing. All of us are here this morning because somebody, somewhere, had some influence on us to try and teach us what was right. And how blessed we are to know what's right. And we need to teach our kids. Don't look down your nose on those who don't know what's right. Be salt and light. Do right to be an example, to bring others to the light, so that they can know the Lord also. We need to have high standards for our children because we're training them to be children of God. Well, the second mistake we need to avoid is Eli put his son's physical well-being over their spiritual well-being. Go to 1 Samuel chapter 2, beginning in verse 22. We read verses 22 and 23. Let's read them again and then continue reading just a little further. Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything his sons did to all Israel and how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So he said to them, "Why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil deeds from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear, and you make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him?" Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father, because the Lord desired to kill them. Who was Eli to these young men? Well, he was their father. There's a sense in which he was also their boss. He was the high priest. And he could have taken steps to see that these men did not serve in the tabernacle if it were necessary. But I want to ask, what would it have meant for Eli to condemn his sons or even to remove his sons from their office? Well, if Hophni and Phinehas were kicked out of the priesthood, it would have meant financial and social ruin for them. But isn't that exactly what they needed? It wasn't what Eli was willing to do. He spared them physical pain and embarrassment, but in so doing, he lost his boys. He lost them spiritually, and ultimately they were killed physically. I'll admit that the priesthood presented special physical challenges for raising humble, godly children. If you were a priest in Israel in this time, you had high social standing. You had great influence over the nation. You had higher education standards and accessibility. You had easy wealth by ancient standards. On the hierarchy of the ancient world, you had royalty and then you had the priesthood right under it, and there was no royalty in Israel. It was truly a position of privilege. That word is thrown around a lot in our culture, but they truly were privileged in their position. And raising children who aren't entitled and arrogant and lacking empathy is often more difficult in an environment like that, that environment of privilege, than in a poor environment. And we need to be aware of that because, frankly, that's our environment here in America. That we have wealth and we have education and we have social standing and all of those sorts of things. And so we need to know and remember and communicate and demonstrate with our kids that keeping high physical standing is not the ultimate good. To know God is what life is all about. And what kind of job you have, where you go to school, your extracurricular success, how much money you make, whether you're admired by people, all of those things can be good. All of those things the world praises, but they don't really matter if you're not right with God. It matters, sure, but ultimately, eternally, it doesn't. What really matters is if you know the Lord. Do my kids know that? Do they see that in me? And do your kids see that in you? Well, how do we communicate that to them? We want our kids to be successful physically, sure. We want them to be successful in the classroom. We want them to have friends. We want them to be in band or sports or UIL or debate or 4-H or FFA and whatever it is they're involved in, we want them to be successful in that. And we as parents spend thousands of dollars and thousands of hours to try and make it so. But are we as committed to spiritual things as we are to these physical things? We don't want social ruin for our kids. Who does, right? Nobody wants their child to be the weirdo or the outcast or not like everybody else. And yet sometimes we have to make stands with our children that you're not going to wear what everyone else wears. You're not going to go where everybody else goes. You're not going to see or listen to what everybody else sees or listens to. And that doesn't necessarily bring social ruin. But what if it does? Isn't that a small price to pay compared to spiritual ruin? We don't want financial ruin for our kids. Who does, right? But have we shown that I'd be willing to quit my job tomorrow if it separated me from my God? Have we encouraged them to choose where they go to college and what they do for a living and who they marry based on what's best for them spiritually, not just physically? And are we having those conversations with them from an early age? Are we having spiritual conversations at all? Are we reading and studying as a family? Or like Eli, are we just bringing them to church? Sunday, Wednesday, gospel meetings, maybe even devotionals. And all of those things are good and right and important and necessary and essential. But just bringing them to church, raising them in the church, as we say, for most kids, that's not enough. They need to know from their parents, from their grandparents, from those that they look up to and hold in high esteem, that spiritual success is the highest good of life, to know God. And if they make it to heaven, anything else is just gravy. Well, Eli put their physical well-being over their spiritual well-being. And the text tells us in chapter 2 and verse 29 that he honored his sons more than he honored God. Read there in verse 29, as God says to Eli, "Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering, which I have commanded in my dwelling place, and honor your sons more than me, to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people." God calls Eli out. And he says, look, you honor your sons more than you do me. I know that you love me. I know that you honor me. But you honor your sons more. And how we raise our children is a reflection of how much we love God. Our kids need to know that God comes first. And listen to me very closely, please. Our kids need to know that God comes before them in our lives. We live in a very kid-centered world. And our kids need to see the world as God-centered. We need to take time to talk about these things. And it takes time, doesn't it? When I was a kid, my sister and I are 5 years apart and very different personalities. And verbal sparring was something that took place a great deal, especially in the car, right? And so we're in the back of the minivan and no TVs and those sorts of things back then. And so we're just going back and forth and back and forth and gripe and complain and whine and moan. And finally, one of the parents would speak up, and my mom or dad, and say, "Okay, nobody says anything else until you each give me 10 things that you're thankful for." Oh, it was the worst, wasn't it? It was just awful. And so we'd have to alternate going back and forth until we said 10 things that we were thankful for. And by the end of the exercise, of course, we were shamed in the way we were acting and our attitude. But that takes time, doesn't it? It takes investment to do things like that. To pray together as a family every single day, that takes time and commitment. To have a Bible study every morning or every night, even when nobody feels like it or it was a late night the night before, that takes time and commitment to talk about God's creation when you see things instead of just rushing on through. That takes time. To ask questions and to answer those questions, it takes time, doesn't it? And when our kids come to us with questions about God and about His creation or even about His existence, questions about the Bible and what it teaches, it takes time for us to be prepared to answer those questions. Or perhaps it takes time for us to go and figure out what the answer is and come back to them with an answer. But all of that is time that is well spent if we are honoring God and seeking to do it all with joy that God is glorified. And our kids need to see more than duty to a certain church or duty to God. They need to see us love and honor God. Eli loved God, but he didn't love God first. He didn't honor Him as God. And our parents, our kids need parents who are doing more than their duty. Maybe duty is underrated in our world. Doing our duty is a good and right thing, but they need to see more than that. They need to see parents who love and serve God with all of our hearts, where God and service to God is not just a small part of our lives or even a big part of our lives. It is our life. That we honor God first and foremost. That we honor God before anything else. That the reason why I get up in the morning, the reason why I'm taking up space and breathing oxygen on this planet is to serve and honor God. And if they see that in us, it will make an impression on them and how they might know God through us. And then, number four, we see that Eli, he did not restrain or rebuke his children like he should have. And by that I mean when they were young and malleable. If we go to 1 Samuel chapter 3 and verse 13... we remember on this occasion, this is where Samuel is sleeping and he hears someone call out to him, "Samuel." And so he runs into Eli and he says, "Here I am." And Eli says, "Go back to bed. I didn't call you." And so he goes back to bed and the Lord calls him again, "Samuel." And so Samuel runs into Eli and he says, "Here I am." And he says, "I didn't call you. Lie back down." And so again, the third time, the Lord calls Samuel and he goes into Eli and says, "Here I am. Did you call me?" And Eli gets it. He perceives the Lord is calling out to this boy. And so he says, "If you hear the voice again, say, 'Speak, Lord, your servant hears.'" And so that's exactly what happens. God calls out, "Samuel, Samuel." And God speaks Samuel says, "Speak, your servant hears," and the Lord speaks to Samuel, and he tells him what's going to happen with Eli and his sons, and that judgment is coming upon them. And we see ultimately that Samuel has some maturity. The next morning, Eli has to come and ask him, "Hey, did the Lord call out to you again?" And Samuel finally tells him all of the judgment that the Lord has appointed to him. And among that that the Lord communicated is found there in verse 13. "For I have told him," that is Eli, "that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them." Literally, he did not rebuke them. Now that couldn't have been talking about when they were adults, I don't think, because we see in the text in chapter 2 that he rebuked them on that occasion. But when they were children, he did not restrain them or rebuke them as he should have as their father. And our kids need to learn immediate obedience at an early age. It is our job as parents to restrain them and rebuke them. By the point that we see Eli and his sons, in many ways it was too late because they were adults making their own decisions. Our kids don't have to know the why yet, but they should know the what. One of the things that we ask our girls, we say, "When do you obey?" And they're supposed to reply, "Right away." Well, that's something that they have to learn, right? And we have to teach them, teach our kids. We don't hurt others. We don't throw fits. We don't take without asking. We don't lie. We don't talk about people behind their backs. We speak kindly to others. And we obey our parents. And then we have to enforce those things after we've taught them. Madison is playing some Little Dribblers basketball, but she's also played a year of soccer. That's just a lot of fun. It's like a swarm of bees around a ball, you know, as they go across the soccer field. And she's a pretty good little athlete. And she had a pretty good little team, won a lot of games, and it was a lot of fun. My wife, Stephanie, played soccer and coached some soccer on the high school level. And so she was the coach of a bunch of 5-year-old boys and girls. It was a crazy experience. And we got the opportunity to know some of the other parents and try and have an influence on them and so forth. And there was one mother, and she was always a little run ragged by the time we got to practice. And her boy was high energy, man. And he was a pretty good little soccer player, too. But after one of the practices, he had left his water bottle over on the other side of the field by the net. And so she said, "Son, I want you to go back and get your water bottle." And he said, "No." Well, I know what happens to my girls when that happens, right? And so he said, "No." And she said, "No, I really need you to go and get your water bottle." He said, "No." She said, "I'm telling you, go get your water bottle." And he looked her dead in the eye and said, "Never." At 5 years old. Oh, I was coming unglued, right? Well, what did she do? She walked over to the net, picked up the water bottle, and they went home. I feel bad for her, but I feel bad for him. How will he ever learn to obey anyone? Consistency is the big issue. If it's wrong, it's always wrong. If it's expected, it's always expected. If we say we're going to do it, we're going to do it. And that includes the consequences to behavior. And an occasional severe rebuke, a big punishment, followed by periods of ignoring bad behavior just makes everyone frustrated. The parents, the kids, and everybody in between. As parents, we have to be the parent. We have to be consistent. Stephanie and I are both very, very competitive people. We think about it this way. We have to win every single day. Well, let me tell you, there have been some days we've lost. But we've won more days than we've lost. We need to bend the will of our children to our own. And if we don't bend their will to yours, if you don't do that, how will they ever learn to bend their will to God's? Your child needs to know who is the head of the home, and it is not them. They are called in Ephesians chapter 6 to obey their parents in the Lord. And we as parents take on part of the responsibility in helping them to obey that command from God. And maybe you say, whoa, wait a second, preacher. You got two little girls. I bet they're just sweet as sugar. I've got a stubborn child. I've got a hard-headed child. Well, praise God for stubborn children. I've got two little girls, as I said. One of them's pretty easygoing. The other one is a little more hard-headed or a lot more hard-headed. But it was actually the easygoing one that I had this particular experience with. You know, as parents, you make bold proclamations and sometimes you just think you're just such an idiot afterwards, right? But you do it, right? And so we told Madison, our oldest, this was a couple of years ago, we said, you're going to eat these beans that Stephanie had fixed. They were just a side dish with the rest of the meal. And she said, I don't want beans. I don't like those beans. We said, fine. Here are five beans. You got to eat these five beans. You just got to try them. Eat those five beans. And that'll be it. That'll be it. So she eats the rest of her meal, but she hadn't eaten the beans. I said, no, you're going to eat the beans. It's going to happen. You're going to eat the beans. I said, no, I'm not going to eat the beans. That was a little bit unusual for her. Usually she obeyed. We said, no, you're eating the beans. She said, I'm not going to eat the beans. So we end up taking her and spanking her and saying, no, you're going to eat the beans. It's funny what you draw lines in the sand on, right? Well, at this point, it's a battle of wills. It's not about the beans anymore. And she says, I'm not going to eat those beans. So we said, you're not eating anything else till you eat those five beans. And there's wailing and moaning and gnashing of teeth. Well, we all go to bed, right? Beans aren't eaten. Stephanie puts some styrofoam or something, or saran wrap over the top of them. And we all go to bed. We get up the next morning and Madison's ready for breakfast. And so Stephanie says, you're not getting breakfast till you eat the beans. She says, I'm not eating those beans. So she doesn't eat the beans for breakfast, doesn't have any breakfast. Lunchtime comes along. She's hungry for lunch. And we say, you got to eat the beans. And she says, I'm not eating the beans. And by this point, we're just about broken, right? So the rest of the story is that afternoon, I go and play golf with Chris Emerson while Stephanie's left home trying to make these beans happen. And so we're texting back and forth. Has she eaten the beans yet? No, she hadn't eaten the beans yet. And finally, she relents and eats the beans. And we can all rejoice at that. I know what it's like to have a stubborn kid. But just imagine what a blessing that will be if we win and show her what submission is, show her what obedience is, and ultimately we can get all that hard-headedness and stubbornness turned in the right direction. If she can be stubborn in following God, if she can be stubborn in doing what's right, stubborn in only following the truth, if you can turn all of that stubbornness toward righteousness, what a blessing. What a blessing it can be. But if our children don't consistently see consequences, how will they learn anything except the strength of their own will? That I want what I want and I'm going to make it happen by my own power and by my own might. And even more, how will they ever truly comprehend God's grace? I had an article sent to me. It was a blog post by a mother. And this was supposed to be a true story. It really happened to her. And this mother had a preteen son. I think he was 11 or 12. And they were having all sorts of trouble with him. Trouble at home, trouble at school. He just wouldn't mind. He wouldn't obey. They were getting called up to the school all the time. And these were believers. And so they wanted him to know God. And they wanted him to know what was right. And they wanted him to follow God. And so they tried everything that they knew to do. They had consequences. They would send him to his room. They would ground him. They would take away things. They used corporal punishment with this child. And nothing seemed to work. He was just belligerent. He wouldn't listen. And so she gets called to school again. The principal's on the line and little whatever his name was is back in the principal's office. And so she drives up to school and she says she was sitting in her car and she was weeping, because she just didn't know what to do. So she went into the principal's office. So she got the young man and didn't say anything. And he knows what's coming. You know, he's had months of it. And they get into the car. And she drives. She's not saying anything. He's sure not saying anything. They drive to the ice cream shop and they go in and she buys him an ice cream cone and he thinks she's lost her mind, right? And they eat their ice cream cone and they start talking and he just breaks down and apologizes and they talk it out. And she says in this blog post that his behavior was so much better from that day forward. What's the point of that story? It's not, if you're having trouble, go buy your kid ice cream. But be consistent as a parent. Be consistent in your discipline. Be consistent in making them obey. Be consistent in your commitment to God. So when you make the choice not to punish them, it means something to them. They know what grace really is. Because they've seen consequences. They've seen what rebuke and restraint really is. What is our goal in all of this? We can't make our children know God, but we want to give them the best possible chance to know the Lord. And may I suggest, if you're not yet a Christian this morning, that is exactly our desire for you. Maybe you need God's grace. Maybe you've been going through life and it's a struggle and nothing seems to work out right. Maybe you're searching for something. Maybe you've seen consequences to your sin. And may I suggest that if we see the consequences that ultimately our sins have left us separated from God, that the wages of sin is death and we have no hope for the life to come. It is only when we see our own sin that we can truly appreciate what God has done for us by His grace. And if you see your sin this morning and you're tired of it, God has provided a way through the sacrifice of His Son for you to be made clean and holy and right once more. Whatever you have done, all of that can be washed away in that watery grave of baptism. Don't wait any longer, but come even this morning and put Christ on in baptism that you might rise to walk in newness of life. Perhaps you're already a Christian this morning and you know that there is sin in your life that you need to get rid of. God's grace is available to you also. And these brethren are here for you to support you and uplift you and uphold you, to be patient with you. And we will strive to do whatever we can to help you. We'll pray for you. We'll pray with you. All you have to do is come to the front while together we stand and while we sing.